Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. In February of 2025, I spoke to Mukulika Banerjee, Professor in LSE's Department of Anthropology. Professor Banerjee was inaugural Director of the LSE South Asia Center. Her books include Cultivating Democracy, Politics and Citizenship in Agrarian India, Why India Votes, The Path and Unarmed and the Sari with Daniel Miller, and the series Exploring the Political in South Asia. We spoke about using anthropology to better study politics, how the U.S. might be turning into what she terms a checklist democracy, and how seeing the U.S. from an outside point of view might help Americans to understand their own politics better. I began by asking Professor Banerjee to outline her research and current work.
So I am a social anthropologist who has been studying democracy for the last 25 odd years. The research on democracy that I've been doing has been done in the context of a rural site, a village in India. But the way anthropology works is that you study a phenomenon in one place where you get to know everybody and everything. It's very holistic as a social science. But then you think about concepts like democracy much more comparatively and see what the insight that that kind of long-term engagement of ethnographic work gives you to understand the concept, in this case, democracy itself. So I've been thinking about democratic theory, what its problems are, what we can contribute to it on the basis of people who are citizens living in a democracy, who think about it on a daily basis, what they have to contribute and how they can reshape democratic theory. Now, I should say that, you know, when I started this work more 25 years ago, it was an interesting research question. I had a research question which was to try and find an answer to this survey finding in India, where in the late 90s, it showed that the socially disadvantaged in India voted in very high numbers, and that India bucked the trend on turnouts globally, especially compared to the older Euro-American democracies. And nobody could really explain why India's voter turnout kept going up or why socially disadvantaged groups were voting more. And so my question really was, why India votes? Why does India vote? So it was an interesting research project which consumed my interest for a long time. Now, in 2025, this has become a disaster project, you know, where I hadn't imagined that in the span of studying democracy, it would come under such severe threat. So now the way one is thinking about democracy and democratic theory, what do citizens have to contribute, et cetera, are questions that have become politically urgent in a way that they simply weren't 20 years ago.
So some of our listeners may not be familiar with anthropology as a discipline or its relevance to politics. What unique advantages does anthropology offer in studying politics and power compared to other academic disciplines?
What a great question. Okay, so let's take democracy itself. Usually, a lot of social scientists that study a phenomenon like democracy tend to focus mostly on its institutional structure. So it is, what are the components of a democratic system that make it such, right? So the principle of separation of powers, political parties, political identification, mobilization according to identity. These are the kinds of things that political science and other related disciplines study when they look at democracy. An anthropologist coming into this is immediately aware of two things. One is that there is a top-down theoretical model of what makes up a democratic system, but people's perceptions of these institutions, what they make of it and their understanding of them, could be a whole different beast. And we need to understand that subjective engagement with democracy on the part of citizens as well. And secondly, and very crucially, The overemphasis on elections and institutions means that the study of democracy somehow gets neglected once those elections are over, because they're big ticket events, right? They're like sporting contests. There are winners and there are losers. And then you try and explain why somebody won and why somebody lost. And as if democracy ends the moment the results are out. And as an anthropologist, I've always been interested in those inter-electoral temporalities when the democracy or the system that's been put in place or the government that has been voted into power then has to produce a democratic culture. Right? It has to create a society that is governed by democratic principles. So if you want to understand democracy in the round, you have to think about those institutions of democracy, but also look at the culture of democracy that it actually creates. And the moment you do that, in those inter-electoral temporalities, the role of the citizen, of accountability, of transparency, of robustness of institutions, all of these things become just as important as electoral contests. And that is something that anthropologists are, or certainly my anthropological take on democracy has been along those lines. The second thing, which is unique to anthropology, is that of all the social sciences, it quite uniquely places great importance on long-term engagement in any field site, right? Which means that you don't, if you're studying political concepts of democracy or citizenship, you don't see it as only an aspect of their political lives, but you see them in the round, how their political opinions and political behavior intersect with their kinship relations, with their religious beliefs, with their economic activity. Because people live in the round, right? None of us can be divided away from our religious selves or our beliefs or behaviors in other parts of life in distinction to politics. So when I say anthropology is a holistic social science, that's what we mean, that if you want to understand democracy and democratic culture as created through elections, you can't do that in exclusion of looking at what kind of democratic culture is produced in other social areas of life. And the third key thing, which is really quite unique to anthropology, because we do long-term engaged ethnographic work, there is a great misunderstanding about what ethnographic work is. People think, oh, getting out of your offices and getting on a plane and visiting a field site and doing field work is ethnographic work. Actually, the hallmark of ethnography, it really is to pay equal attention to the non-discursive as the discursive. So people say a lot of stuff. So if you were to ask people, what do you think of X politician, they will say things that you think are their beliefs. But actually, when they go to vote, they may be voting for that same person they have castigated to you. So there is always this slippage between what we say when asked a question as opposed to what we do when we are having to make a decision and act. So it is only because as anthropologists, we observe as much as we ask. We are not walking around all the time with a clipboard asking people questions. We are becoming part of the social fabric. We are becoming part of the furniture of a society. We are able to see what people are likely to do and what they do, regardless of what they have said. And so when you use this methodology of ethnographic work that pays importance to the non-discursive, in the study of politics and study of democracy, it becomes absolutely critical. And I think in the current moment, where there is so much polarization around utterances, about saying the right things or saying this or saying that, how people actually behave becomes just as important to pay attention to.
So in a piece for the U.S. Center's blog, USAP, the day after the 2024 U.S. presidential election, you wrote that the U.S. was in danger of becoming what you called a checklist democracy. What do you mean by this?
I'll tell you, Chris, when I wrote that piece the day after the elections, what I meant by it and what I mean by it now, once President Trump's administration has already been in post nearly a month now, has shifted slightly. So let me explain both the different meanings. That initial idea of a checklist democracy was very much coming out of a post-war scenario in which there were some democracies and a lot of newly independent nations aspired in Asia, Africa, Latin America, aspired to be democracies. And some did not manage that transition. They turned into authoritarian regimes. But there was a certain desirability of countries adopting democratic forms as the ideal form of government. And so countries, newly independent countries, were measured by how democratic they were. And the measurement was literally quite quantitative in many ways, that you expected it to display certain characteristics that certain countries in Europe and America and North America had, which was, do they have separation of power? Do they have free and fair elections? Is there a free media? This was the checklist. And then post fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, in that post-socialist transition phase, when a lot of those Eastern European countries were now transitioning to becoming democracies, there was a certain financial and institutional push by the United States and others to create democracies. And there, the creation of this democratic transition was seen to be very much in that political science way that we were discussing earlier about setting up institutions. Right? So if you set up the right institution, somehow you would create democracy. And so those institutions were set up. And lo and behold, some contexts there was democracy and some there weren't. Because obviously creating a democratic culture requires a lot more than parachuting in some models of institutions. So there was a reduction somehow of the democratic project to a checklist of certain characteristics that if you had, you were deemed a democracy, regardless of what kind of society you were creating. In the aftermath of the 2024 results, and just as they came out, it seemed to me that America was beginning to look like the model that it had own created, that there was a certain institutional checklist that it may fulfill. There were free and fair elections. There were opposing parties. People could express their opinion. The media was more or less free. But it didn't seem that the manner in which political conversation was being conducted was at all democratic. It wasn't as if there was a civility that is such an important part of democratic culture, which doesn't mean politeness. It means respecting all points of views to be aired without raising of tempers, for instance. That simply did not seem to be the case. So at that point when I said it, you know, and the other point that I wish to make there was that a lot of people on that day who would not have voted for President Trump said, how on earth could the United States produce a result like this? Who are these Americans? What have they? This is not a country we recognize, etc. And I was very minded that somehow there was a portrayal of American democracy as if it was flawless, as if it hadn't been complicit through its agencies and the U.S. State Department and others over decades of interfering in democratically conducted elections in other countries when governments were toppled because they weren't seen to be friendly to the U.S. regime. Henry Kissinger was a very important player in this story. And so it seemed important on that day to point out that if you were watching the United States, located in Latin America or Africa or anywhere in Asia, one's encounter with the hallowed credentials of US democracy was rather different. People saw it as a meddler, as an anti-democratic, anti-electoral force that was willing to interfere in national politics across the globe to serve its own self-interest in a way that wasn't at all democratic, right? So this was a point of view that is widely shared in large parts of the world. And in a sense, you know, it seemed like the coming full circle of that story for America itself, where they had to confront this underbelly of what America is capable of on that day through that result. Now, I dare say, with the self-confessed, and this is not my reading or judgment of what is going on in America, but the self-confessed goals of the Trump or Mump administration, as some people have started to call it, of the Musk plus Trump administration, is that in the name of government efficiency, what is in fact being done is a dismantling of that institutional structure of democratic institutions. So frankly, by those standards, the US probably wouldn't actually even pass muster on that checklist anymore. And it's entirely intentional. So that's what I mean about my position having shifted, that, you know, in November, you could still call it a checklist democracy. 2-3 months later, it begins to look like it is, it doesn't anymore qualify as a democratic country.
So in your 2022 book, Cultivating Democracy, Politics and Citizenship in Agrarian India, you explore how democratic values are shaped in the everyday of rural India. How did your ethnographic study inform you of democratic cultivation, and what lessons might it provide for the US?
Cultivation is what farmers do, right? You grow crops, and for that, you have to undergo a process. There is no shortcuts. You have to prepare the soil. You have to nourish it. You have to choose the right seed. You have to watch over those early green sprouts. You have to be vigilant over a period of weeks and months for pests, for changes of weather. You've got to protect that crop, and then you can harvest. This is what farming and cultivation is like. And this is what I learned just being with paddy farmers in India during my research. And I think therein lies a lesson for the kind of activity each of us as citizens living in democracies need to do. We need to be more like those farmers. We need to work hard. We need to be vigilant. We need to be patient, and we need to be hopeful and take a sense of responsibility for this crop that we are producing. And so this idea of cultivation is really about what you do in a democracy once the elections are over. Can you afford to say, okay, I've had my government, I've elected the party I wanted into government, or my party did not win. Okay, I'm going to go off and lead my life, and I will come back in 4 years' time, 5 years' time to vote again. If you do that, say, with a crop, you're not going to have anything to harvest because you need to look after it, right? And this is the fundamental lesson, I think, that working with farmers who think about democracy has taught me, and which we are all learning to our great cost at the moment, is that there has been the opposite of cultivation is complacency. And there has been a huge amount of complacency about living in democracies, about democracy always delivering certain freedoms, about institutions enduring regardless of whether we look after them. It has always been deferred to somebody else. It is representatives should do their work, or the civil servants should be making the right decisions. Journalists must, break stories and hold the feet to the fire of politicians. It's as if the rest of us, as ordinary citizens, have nothing to do except to wait to exercise our sovereign right the next time elections come along. So I think the first takeaway is that if we don't cultivate democracy on a daily basis, it is going to shrivel up and die, as it is shriveling up and dying in real time at the moment. At the moment, that's what's happening. The second aspect of my research, which, you know, helps me think about how to be this kind of citizen that cultivates democracy, is also, again, to pay attention to the life of those paddy farmers I lived with, that they learn democratic values, or they learn to behave in a democratic fashion, not just at the polling station. They learn this in how, despite deep social cleavages, they're able to work together to bring in the harvest. There is a fundamental lesson about cooperation despite difference. In the realm of kinship, you think, people who are sworn enemies or, you know, people who don't have had a huge falling out in a family scandal saga can come together when they realize there is a larger threat that needs to be dealt with and they are able to bury their differences to come together. In, say, the realm of religion, this was largely Muslim paddy farmers. They celebrated so many festivals, and the hallmark of a lot of these Islamic rituals and festivals was that, yes, you can celebrate, yes, you can consume a lot of food and wear nice clothes, but don't do it alone, because a feast always tastes better if everybody around you has something to eat. They might not have as much as you, but if everybody has a little bit, you've given away some of the feast to others who don't have nothing, then your own feast tastes better. Now, this is the kind of thinking, you know, so religion in that feast example delivers and instills a very fundamental understanding of the need for redistribution, that everybody is not born equal. You cannot create complete equality, but what you can create is basic dignity for everybody. And so this value, this democratic value, I would call redistribution one of those democratic values, is cultured and inculcated in a completely non-political setting like a religious ritual. Similarly, in that, you know, kinship example, the fact that there are certain moments in which you bury difference and come together and learn to work together, that kind of cooperation, as with the harvest too, where you can deliberate without falling out, that you can disagree and learn to disagree and still learn to work together. These are quite fundamental to the democratic project, because part of the anxiety that we are all expressing and experiencing at the moment with what we call polarization is the complete inability to pull together on any agenda. So if you are either with us or on the other side on every single issue, as if there are no cross-cutting issues that bind people together. And so, you know, again, learning from the farmers, it is one of the things that we need to do as citizens in universities, elsewhere, is also to think about spaces that we need to preserve, such as, I don't know, gardening clubs or street parties on neighborhoods or orchestras on university campuses or team sports, things that we do without an agenda other than its purpose of producing a piece of music or a winning team or, you know, just playing together or a communal garden, which have nothing to do with politics, but serve the function of bringing a very disparate group of people together. And this I have learned from watching village society very closely, which is absolutely riven by social division. In, you know, and in India, the caste system is so brutal that it divides people permanently. And yet people find the resources to come together. And I think that is a genuinely inspiring lesson for our times.
Is the US's return to right-wing populist leadership part of a global shift in electoral politics, or is it leading the trend?
The US is behind the trend. It is this shift, in a sense, many of us who've been watching this global shift to the right have been talking about it, but of course it was never important enough because the US wasn't there. And, you know, that there's a sort of hegemonic claim that the US makes to that kind of space. But, you know, people who have lived in Hungary or Turkey or India or under Bolsonaro in Brazil have been observing not just a shift to the right, which each of them have demonstrated, but quite critically, how much the credibility of a democratic veneer has been to these regimes. So they have wanted to be known as democracies. Very authoritarian leaders have wanted to gain power through elections which legitimize their power. These are not military coups we are talking about. These are all democratically elected leaders. And in a sense, Mr. Trump's win is a continuation of that trend, where you can take an election and win it and then stamp your agenda. Now, the difference, I think, with what's happening in the US at the moment and these others is that the degradation of democratic norms that has happened in the context that I just mentioned has been subtle but certain. There has been a hollowing out of the legitimacy of the electoral process, for instance, in a country like India, which used to be famous for its fantastic elections, fantastically conducted elections. It's lost that integrity in a large measure, right? People in the US are now witnessing a wrecking ball being taken to that set of institutions that gave the US legitimacy as a democracy without any thought to whether the US is going to look like a democracy anymore. The message is, we don't care. You know, so this is in any other context, and I've been thinking about this a lot in the last few days, that in any other context, we would call this a coup, where you basically overthrow a regime, you fire its administration, its civil servants, you send everybody home, you just cancel budgets, you take over. It's a takeover of the US government by people who are not professionals meant to be running a government. If this happened in Africa or Latin America, you would call this a coup. So I'm waiting for the day when somebody will start to describe this situation as a coup, which is what it is. It's a coup this time, not by the military. It's a coup by billionaires who clearly think the US government machinery is there to further their interests, whether it is getting rid of regulations or furthering a certain kind of thinking about the kind of society we want. This is a takeover, right? To go back to your question, I think the US is now in a place where it has caught up with a lot of the other right wing. Of course, the moment it brings its heft and its might and its money to these other regimes, Germany is about to have elections. We know what happened with the US president meeting the leader of the AFD. This is a clear message that not only have we taken control of the mothership in the United States, we are now here to help our satellites all over the universe. In London, there's been a three-day meeting of the Alliance of Responsible Citizenship, and it's a who's who gathering of like-minded people of a certain political agenda who've come together to support each other in complete solidarity, even though they're all functioning in contexts that are very distinct across Europe and America. So I think the US is finally caught up, but in typical US style, it's come in from the behind, but it's now taking the lead through sheer money and muscle.
One of the Trump administration's hallmark policies has been the withdrawal from global institutions. Where does this leave the rest of the world, and how might other global actors respond to the US's retrenchment from global politics?
You know, to go back to that piece I wrote in November, which you quoted earlier, there was a global understanding, it was called, about the rules-based order, of which the United States was committed to. Now, this is the kind of language you hear in across the Atlantic, around here, Europe and America. The rest of the world, this rules-based order looked a little bit hollow for the reasons that I outlined before, that America seemed to have get behind certain kinds of rules-based orders only if it served US interests. That earlier deferring to the norms of a rules-based order, which people, like I said, in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, always saw to be slightly hypocritical, that hypocrisy has kind of disappeared. So while there is a lot of anxiety in Europe and America about America's pulling out of NATO, say what it does to, you know, it hasn't officially done it, but it has effectively done that. If the US can go over the head of Europe and deal directly with Putin in Russia, what does this do to the status of Europe? Yeah, there's a huge amount of anxiety around these issues. From the rest of the world, this may look quite different until there is a recognition of how much responsibility the US was expected to take in terms of military assistance or simply financial assistance it offered in soft power terms through USAID and others to the rest of the world. And that too now has both the soft power and the hard power seems to be aligning away. I mean, President Trump saying that why should we be giving money through USAID programs to countries that are the sixth largest economy in the world, or we are going to have reciprocal tariffs on all countries, seems to be speaking to a global order as if there was no slavery, there was no colonialism, there were no empires, as if there was no global consensus, post-colonial global consensus, that certain countries had to be redressed for wrongs, historical injustices, and therefore were allowed higher tariffs. So the higher tariffs from poorer countries was allowed precisely to help them catch up after the colonial disaster and so on. But there is no reckoning of any of this global thinking on it. And so, like I said, that hypocrisy of propagating a global rules-based order when it suited US interests is now absolutely naked. And there is no softening blow of the soft diplomacy that used to happen in the past.
So thinking from a global perspective or a global South perspective, do you think that Americans could better understand their own politics if they tried or were able to see the US from the outside? And is this even possible?
I would like to think it's possible. This is not a world that does not allow travel or knowledge about the rest of the world. While you can, you don't have to leave your living room and you can find out a lot about the world, but it is about education and about creating a frame of mind where there is curiosity about the world. I don't know what the very latest figures are, but the proportion of Americans who do not have passports and therefore have no desire to travel outside the United States has always been a very interesting statistic to me, because for large parts of the world, if you have wealth, the one thing you do is travel, right? It's the one thing. And if you have such a powerful passport as the United States does, if you have a passport, powerful passport and lots of money, why wouldn't you travel? And you wouldn't travel because A, you're not aware that the world is vast and has a complex history and that, you know, your own country's history is quite intertwined there. You wouldn't travel because your country is very vast and beautiful and you don't need to go and sample it anywhere else. I mean, I'm always struck traveling in the United States on holiday, how much the domestic tourism market, you know, it is in the national parks and so on. It's overwhelmingly Americans discovering their own country, which is great. But it is not just about travel. In large parts of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, people don't have the money to travel. They have never been abroad, but they're very well informed because they have a stake in remaining very well informed. They know their history. They know the role. You know, they can give you an account of the Vietnam War and the US's role of it 3-4 generations down the line today in a way that you simply probably won't get at the United States because people have a stake in it. And if you have been exploited and interfered with and invaded and decimated in some cases, then you would have a stake in it, right? So this is the powerful never need to know. It's everybody else that needs to remain informed. And it does make me think that this current inflection point where so much is rapidly changing and America has faced a coup from within, whether this may in fact make Americans think about what is happening in America more comparatively. They will. I mean, at the moment, you know, it's still early days. There is a sense of this is uniquely American, and maybe actually looking to history and looking elsewhere might help them understand this better.
Well, before we finished, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to point our audience's attention to any projects or work you have coming or working on right now.
Oh, thank you. That's a very kind offer. Well, let me mention first that LSE now has reinstated the tradition of inaugural lectures. And on the 5th of March, I'll be delivering my inaugural lecture where I will be looking at this concept of cultivation more deeply, and especially the role of the university and its relationship to democracy, which I think we need to do as universities, as academics and students. And the second thing is I have my own podcast, as you know, which it's called The India Briefing, which I do with my co-host Pragya Tiwari, a very senior journalist based in Delhi. And our latest episode, which has just dropped, in fact, is examining the Indo-US relations, because Prime Minister Modi was the fourth head of state, to visit Washington and visit President Trump. They have a long camaraderie that goes back to both their first terms. And so there is, we are told, personal chemistry, but that relationship of what it means for India in this new scenario was one that needed to be examined. And we've got two very fine commentators to think about it. And it also, I think it is, I mean, we're doing the podcast, The India Briefing, for anyone who is curious about India, trying to understand it. But I also think in understanding India's place in this new scenario is a good way to also think about a lot of countries of similar size and status and what kind of transactional diplomacy is coming their way.
Well, thanks so much for that. Our listeners should check out links to those resources in our show notes. Just remains me to say, Professor Mukulika Banerjee, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you very much.
Mukulika Banerjee is Professor of Social Anthropology in LSE's Department of Anthropology. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Mukulika Banerjee for joining us in this episode. For information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Luke Digweed. Our theme tune is by Ranger in the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @lse_us. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.